I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Jonathan, and this episode is 69 of Sagas and Sass, nice. Covering Ephraim's POV chapters from Craft, Part 2 of Dark Age, which is the fifth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
And I'm yet another host, Nick, to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode, and the opinions are those of us as individuals. Don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole, though let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon with 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month. It offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes within 24 hours of us recording them, usually less, and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
Remember when Ephraim set off a bunch of grenades to keep the ship he'd stolen with Pax and Electra from returning to the Syndicate Queen? Well, obviously it caused a catastrophic collision, and then the ship kept sending distress signals to the Queen. But scavengers reached it first, and as Ephraim floats in and out of consciousness, he hears someone ordering to keep him alive because the Queen wills it. When he wakes again, he's restrained, but first Electra and then Pax are hovering over him, so he at least knows they're both alive. Pax reveals they are in fact on Mars, but Ephraim almost immediately falls into a one-track mindset, because although on the one hand he has been shouting for his ring, what he ends up begging for is Zoladone! Pax refuses him on both counts, telling Ephraim he'll return the ring when he is himself again, before leaving him to chant himself to sleep with an old gray marching creed. He wakes up in an indeterminate time later in a large bed. He's been given a brand new leg, and his accommodations are fit for, well, if not a king, at least a brooding but secretly sensitive knight from a Holocan drama, which is probably extra fitting considering he's apparently being held in Eagle's Rest, one-time home of Cassius a Bologna. Oh, and Ephraim has a babysitter, a huge obsidian shaman, who is apparently reading bones that have been scattered in the fireplace. The shaman reveals that Valdir, the unshorn, obsidian warlord, and concubine Dusefi the Quiet is coming to pay a visit. That Ephraim doesn't plan on sticking around for any of that nonsense. Instead, he runs out into the terrace and jumps off, using vines to climb down the sheer and very high wall. But despite unraveling vines and the fact that his fancy new leg is way stronger than he expected, he thinks he's almost made it to safety when what should appear but a riderless griffin, and not just any griffin, God Eater, Sephi's personal steed, who corners Ephraim for the moment. It takes Valdir to finally arrive, trap him in a tack net, and carry him off to be dumped unceremoniously back into the shaman Osgard's care. They trek up a path that ascends the spine of the mountain, and when they arrive at the Bologna training grounds, Ephraim watches first Electra and then Pax training with the Obsidians. But while Electra seems to fit right in, Pax isn't exactly happy to be there, and he makes this known to Sephi after defeating the three Obsidian who are set against him. After Pax storms out, spoiler alert, not the only time he's going to do this, Ephraim is brought to Sephi, who reveals that the scavengers who found them on Luna had Obsidian among them, and that Valdir abused the Syndicate of the notion that they had any claim on Ephraim and the kiddos.
Sephi then takes Ephraim on a walk and shows him the Bologna hangars. Once filled with ships, they are now populated by Obsidians who are learning from orange mechanics, blue navigators, green coders, yellow doctors, red builders, because she plans to break from the Republic and found a kingdom for her people. And BT dubs, she wants Ephraim to teach her Skoogie, Spirit Assassins, Spycraft, among, well, just about anything else he can think of. In return, Sephi will ensure Lyria and Volga are returned to him. And, of course, he'll be paid a hefty sum as well. So what else is Ephraim to do but agree? Let's be real, it's not like he's going anywhere else otherwise. Granted, while the Skookies seem to know more than they let on, there is definitely a language barrier, and on top of that, they don't trust Ephraim, which means they are playing dumb or angry because that's what they learned to do. Thanks a lot, Golds. But hey, while Ephraim might not be feeling like he's doing a ton of good with them, he did secretly help out Pax by convincing Sephi to let him use the garage, where he is now fixing up an old grav bike in his spare time. In return, Pax gives Ephraim a bit of help as well, by giving him very strong hints that he should turn his lessons with the Skoogie into games. which Ephraim does, and while there's still a ways to go after their first gamified lesson, he knows he's finally on the right track. Especially when Freyhild explains that Ephraim teaching them how to play cards is gifting them his own skill gift. TLDR, they are enjoying themselves, but they have also gained respect for their leader. Go Ephraim! Unfortunately, it's only a matter of time before news of the Day of Red Doves reaches Mars, though at first all Ephraim and the kiddos know is that people in the city below are moving through the streets singing Io's song. And even when they are summoned by Sephi, this just gets them loaded into an armored military shuttle, and 4 days later, disembarking that shuttle onto a cruise ship gone schizoid, a luxury cruise ship that Ephraim, in fact, vacationed on with Trigg once upon a time. When they are finally brought before Sephi, it is first to witness the execution of a pink named Amel who betrayed her, a scene that she immediately follows with news of the Sovereign's death. Pax bolts from the room, and Elektra takes Sephi down a peg before storming after him. And even Ephraim is left wondering if Sephi might not be the bad guy here after all. But when she asks if his Skugi can help take the mines she needs for their Helium 3, he shrugs his assent because, hey, the world's burning anyway. Sigh.
Also, Constellation's apparently not Ephraim's thing. He apparently avoids Pax, even though Pax eventually finds him, only to tell Ephraim that he's shit at pep talks. I mean, Ephraim did already admit as much, but even if his words aren't quite the right ones, he's definitely feeling some attachment because he thinks about how if Sephi tells him to use Pax, he'll pop her right between the eyes. I mean, good luck with that. And speaking of Sephi, just then Osgard shows up to fetch Ephraim for the Kirdekan, aka the Lord Wager, which is quite an honor and also signifies that Sephi chose Ephraim's plan over Valdir's. It's one hell of a statement on her part because Valdir is apt to be pissed. And as Ephraim follows Osgard out, Pax advises him to not bleed into the ribcage because if he does and the campaign fails, he'll die in a ritual homicide. Cool, 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 cool. No doubt, no doubt, no doubt. Really, the whole custom is a lot. Sephi splits an Auroch's head open with her axe. Osgard sets the body on fire, and when nothing is left but charred tissue and marrow leaking out of cracked bones, the obsidians begin making their wagers. The women drop strands of hair, meaning they will be shorn if the campaign fails, but the men essentially spit on Ephraim by only wagering Torx. Oh, and Valdir literally spits at him after dropping his Torx in. So there's that. Ephraim's justifiably pissed, lets his pride get the better of him, and does exactly what Pax told him not to do, that being bleed into the rib cage. Turns out Zolodon wasn't just protecting him from feelings and memories, but also from himself. Oopsies. However, in a surprising turn of events, okay, not so much, Sephi follows his lead and also gives her blood to the ritualistic sacrifice. Needless to say, Ephraim is at least 2 times screwed if his plan fails. Oof. So, Ephraim is immediately having some big regrets. Even if Osgard claims Ephraim won't die because Sephi can't die. But then, when Osgard realizes Ephraim has been stress-eating his walnuts, he goes nearly feral because, guess what, y'all? They aren't walnuts. They're the shaman spirit berries, and now Ephraim's high as fuck! Thankfully, this turns out to be a better time than he thought it would be, at least after the initial freakout, during which he dons a far too large pair of grav boots and picks up a rifle of unknown and horrible power. Unfortunately, once the high gets really good, he has a moment of clarification, or so he thinks. Basically, he decides the obsidian's fight is just and that the gods will protect him. And so he just leaps from the transport, just as Osgard is saying, don't do that. His grav boots speed him past the vanguard to be the first to land. And it's only then that he realizes that the rifle is actually just a mop. And he's surrounded by hunter-killer robots. Oopsies.
Oh gosh, there's just a lot of Ephraim fucking up in these chapters, but...
But it's not his fault.
He fucked around and found out a lot, though. Nobody's saying it's his fault. when Ephraim wakes up from the crash he caused with the grenades in the Duke's ship, and the systems are telling him a distress signal was sent to the Duke's employer, he is removed by filthy creatures in tatters and passes out again, wakes up, is sedated, and on and on. When he finally comes to for good, Pax is there dangling his engagement ring in front of him. They're on Mars, and they're withholding Zolidum from Ephraim, and he is not happy about it.
So Pax tells him a story about Trig, in fact, and how when he was a Legionnaire, Golds replaced his stimulants with Zolidum and sent him in as part of a kill squad to butcher 75 men, women, and children who were guilty of nothing but enduring a life of sexual torture and possessing compromising information on loyal members of the ruling regime. Holiday found her brother with a gun in his mouth and encouraged him to seek Ares to make up for the blood on his hands. Pax concludes by saying, "This ring belongs to Ephraim T. Horn. When he asks for it, I'll give it to him."
By the way, the order to go in and murder a bunch of pinks was due to Atalantia. So keep that in mind, because she's the worst.
Well, she can't be the worst because other people have been the worst.
Listen, if we say somebody is the worst, it doesn't matter if we said somebody else is the worst. They're all the worst.
No, this level is of worst. No one is exactly the same.
We're exploring new areas of the worst, Jonathan.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always a new worst to verse. There's always a new worst to raise its head, apparently.
Unless it's bratwurst, in which case that's delicious.
Yes, that is true. I did like that we got this bit about Trig, because we don't really know a ton about him. We get bits from Ephraim, really, in Iron Gold, and now we've gotten a little bit more here and there from Ephraim in Dark Age. We only know Trig in person alive for a short amount of time, and I really hate hearing that this is what happened to him, that he was sent in with this designer drug in his system that he didn't even know he was being given. And that's actually the same drug that Ephraim has been addicted to this whole time is just, it's kind of a gut punch, honestly. And I understand that as an addict, Ephraim, it's hard for him to see it that way, but still, oof. Eventually, Ephraim comes to in a real bed with a brand new leg and no clue who paid for it. Though he does at least quickly realize where on Mars he is, which is Eagle Rest, aka the Bellona stronghold just outside of Olympia. And his babysitter is an obsidian shaman, Osgard. We don't get his name right away, but Osgard can't stop Ephraim from trying to escape. And it's an escape attempt that is both kind of brave and kind of hilarious. He just runs off the terrace and is like riding the vines down, and then he tries to push off to another column and his new leg is too strong and he misses it, and I think he's falling down the vines and burning his hands. It's a failed Mission Impossible. It's like if Mission Impossible was on SNL. That's Ephraim's escape. And then Valdir, the Unshorn, puts the kibosh on the escape and immediately takes Ephraim to see Seffi, who is conveniently watching Elektra and Pax train with some young obsidians. And while Ephraim notes that Elektra appears right at home, Pax actually kind of scares him.
Osgard says that Elektra is a better fighter, but Pax is more dangerous due to the rage festering inside him.
Ephraim calls the fight between Pax and the three obsidian he faces appalling due to its tone of boredom and animal cruelty. Oh, and that Pax fights as if he's seen all of this happen before, with his eyes closed to boot.
When it's over, Seffi asks if Pax mocks them. Then Pax replies, "Mock? No, your majesty. I understand the purpose is to instruct me in the old ways of the obsidian. Your shaman teach the children of the ice that war is the first language of all peoples, but not every war need to be the last. And as a child, I am to be impressed with your wisdom. As a hostage, I am to be convinced by your inclusion in your tribal rites that I am an ally. As ward, I am to impart this lesson upon my people. To be friend of the obsidians who showed me their sacred rituals and treated me with respect. What a pity it is that there will be no obsidians left." The TLDR of that is that Pax is big angry about how the Obsidian abandoned his father and reminds them, this is a war of annihilation and you are outmatched by the darker breed of my kind. I am the son of the Morning Star, the flesh and blood of the man who broke your chains, yet you hold Elektra and me as insurance and to bargain for ships and information. So I look upon you with my father's eyes to ask, what do your old ways say of honor?
In Ephraim's words, damn, son. I do have to kind of argue with, I look upon you with my father's eyes, because Darrow has gold eyes and Pax's eyes have been noted as rose gold.
Real pretty.
I agree.
You could upcharge for that.
Yeah, seriously. There's probably some violet out there who has carved people with rose gold eyes. So eventually Ephraim realizes that the Obsidian are breaking with the Republic, that Sephi wants to found a kingdom for her people. And when Ephraim laughs at her, she goes off about how they were forced to go to war for gold for 700 years and then continued to send their people to die for the Republic. Yet when they asked for homeland, they were given nothing more than rocky islands on Earth. So then they asked for a city and were given the broken ruins of Olympia. And she also says that there is nothing for them on Mercury because they can't live so close to the sun and they are hated there to boot.
Sephi tells them, so now we say the word Ragnar taught us. No, we embrace the truth Morningstar taught us. Destiny is not a given. Destiny is taken.
In Ephraim's words, so much for Sephi the Quiet. I really wanted this to be like a thing, so I tried to insert it as much as possible, but there's a lot of really great in Ephraim's words in his chapters here. As we noted, Sephi wants Ephraim to train her Skoogie, to which she agrees because he doesn't really have a choice, let's be real. He plans on teaching them unconventional domestic warfare, but in true Ephraim fashion, he also says he'll make them appreciate the works of the Spanish surrealists because they are the best artists the world ever conspired to create, and they are unappreciated by modern society. I just like that flashback to him re-stealing the Dali painting in Iron Gold.
It's so good.
Granted, the Skoogie don't learn a lot of things, particularly the spy stuff, as fast as he would like, though Pax does eventually hint to Ephraim that he should use games to help them learn, and that works quite a bit better, at least. He's teaching them a game called Karachi. I'm imagining it's like poker, because there's also a bit in the chapter where he's teaching them Karachi, and he eventually is like, these are the tells. This is how you know when a person is fibbing, whatever. And basically, he's teaching them how to read each other's tells, and they're having fun with it. And it is kind of like a plug for gamified education. But they do learn a lot faster. And also, as we noted in the summary, Freyhild thanks him for teaching them this skill gift because the Obsidians have been going to the casinos, essentially, in Olympia and losing their asses because they have a lot of money, by the way, after all of the fighting they've done and the ships they've taken and whatever else they got this money from. But they have a lot of money, but they've been losing it all. And Ephraim teaching this skill gift also means they can maybe gain some of that back. So they're learning the things he needs them to learn, but they're also learning how to gain back their honor elsewise, which I thought was really neat. Now, there is other stuff going on too, though. Like the fact that Top Skoogie Freyhild, previously mentioned, is having an affair with Valdir, who is, as we've mentioned, Sephi's mate. It's interesting that Freyhild is still very loyal to Sephi otherwise, and she doesn't quite trust Ephraim, telling him that Sephi gave her purpose, gave them all purpose, and that he, Ephraim, will not betray her. This isn't like a, you better not betray her. It's, you will not betray her or else. And Ephraim asks, is that a threat or a prophecy?
And Freyhild tells him, I do not believe in prophecy. I know it is old way. Superstition enslaved my people. I pretend because I must. And because my queen needs my faith, my tribe needs my faith.
Apparently, there's some Obsidians, including this very important one, who aren't super into the faith that was forced upon them by gold. Huh. All this time, Pax and Ephraim are also working on a means of escape. Part of it is the Ephraim getting Pax into the garage, and then he is like, build a harness, wear this harness all the time. Ephraim does have a ship that was gifted to him by Seffy, but of course the kids aren't allowed anywhere near it, et cetera, et cetera. But they have this backup plan where eventually if something happens, they can hopefully get out if need be. Ephraim is also having little dinners and stuff with Pax. They've created a code with their peas on their plates, which is just very cute, honestly. Then Electra busts in on one of their secret planning sessions because there appears to be a mob moving through the streets of Olympia, and they can hear the forbidden song drifting ominously on the wind. And Asgard shows up immediately to say that the queen has summoned them, and they're packed into a military shuttle where they have their own little "Are you afraid of the dark?" type party as Pax tells them all about the Askamani, who apparently might not just be the assholes from the ice tribes who didn't follow Seffy. Their correspondents allude to a central figure, Volsong Fa, as a sort of king.
Pax also notes that not all of the warlords from the Dark Revolt were captured. Some hid in the Kuiper Belt, and apparently they had managed to take some carvers with them. When they were finally spotted, Pax explains, their skin was said to be red, possibly from genetic sculpting with an extremophilic bacterium highly resistant to deep space radiation, vacuum, dehydration, and cold. At first, they weren't a problem. And even when they became one, the Kuiper Belt was too big to waste time searching. So instead, Octavia just sent the Fear Knight on an expedition. He was gone for a year before reporting that the situation was untenable. But Octavia gonna be Octavia. And she told him to go radio silent until he completed his operation. Only to have the Fear Knight return 7 years later, right around the time deep space miners began suggesting that the Askamani had united under a single ruler, an outlander named Volsong. And Pax's conclusion that people just gave the pirates the name Askamani because people like legends. But it makes you wonder, what if they have met with their long-lost brethren? What if they are coordinating and Volsong Fa rules not just the Far Obsidian, but the pirates too?
In Ephraim's words, Pax's shit at bedtime stories. Granted, Pax does apologize, quote unquote, saying that next time he'll tell the tale of Sophocles the clone, a creature so noble and so wise, he learned to cheat death.
Sophocles is the best.
But that's a big info dump on the Askamani, who previously in Iron Gold, we only really heard about them when Cassius and Lysander supposedly ran into them on that ship where they saved Serafina. So this sounds like there's a lot more going on than just some obsidians who are assholes. I feel like that's a thing to put in our pockets, just saying, but also Sophocles. Like, listen, I never used to be a horror movie or show person, but I've actually been in that realm recently. So I'm here for the horror story about the Askamani and Volsong Fa. But also, I would rather hear the tale of Sophocles.
Always.
That could be a great children's book. Pierce, please write a children's book about Sophocles.
Pierce, we need to learn more about Sophocles through a children's book.
I want a story about the 21 histories of Sophocles, please.
Pierce, we know you're listening to our podcast and are an avid fan. We need you to get on this children's book.
He's a very good boy.
Can he wait till he finishes the series first?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. We don't need another Winds of Winter.
Yeah. But back to real life.
Back to reality?
Yeah. Seffy brings Ephraim, Pax and Electra to watch her execute a pink who she believes was informing on her. And she follows up this execution by revealing that the sovereign is dead, killed by a mob, as were her obsidian senators, Archgovernor of Mars Rollo. Yes, that Rollo from the Phobos mission in Morningstar, and more than a dozen others, including some howlers. Oh, and that Severo has been captured.
Pax runs off, and before storming after him, Electra calls Seffy a cold bitch for knowing for 3 days. I'm only now revealing this information, and snaps, you weakened her by leaving. You abandoned them. This is your fault. I know it. He knows it. We all fucking know it. Isn't she like 10?
Yeah, she's 10. She's 10.
The best language from a 10-year-old since Hit Girl.
Listen, she is Severo and Victor's child. After the two kids leave, Ephraim notes, Valdir watches the child go with a deep sense of sadness. He is more complicated than just a warrior. The loyalty he feels to Darrow must be immense, and I wonder if Seffi isn't the villain here after all. In Ephraim's words, is Seffi the villain? And then, even though Ephraim is trying to avoid Pax, apparently, they do meet up again because Pax searches him out, and they are so oddly cute together. Ephraim tells Pax, I want you to get old, which... And even though he doesn't outright deny that Pax is a mark to him, he does kind of brush off that comment. And even though Pax tells Ephraim that he's shit at pep talks, Ephraim just says, yeah, well, maybe that's why I'm alive and why you're wearing Trigg's ring. He was as good as we get, just a shish kebab in the end.
Pax responds, my father wishes he knew him better. And even though Ephraim calls this pandering, Pax insists, truly, say what you want about my dad, but don't ever think he doesn't notice his men. It's the best thing about him. When they go, it breaks him.
Ephraim says, well, he's the one giving the orders.
And Pax tells him someone has to. I don't hate him. I mean, I do, but I don't, if that makes sense. I hate him for leaving Venus, but not for Mercury. At his best, he's how men should be. So maybe that means it's the world that's flawed.
In Ephraim's words, that's the damn truth. I'm really loving this in Ephraim's words thing. Anyway, Valdir and many of the others are mad AF that Seffi chose Ephraim's plan, not Valdir's. Not only that, but when Ephraim let his blood drip into the ox carcass and she followed suit, that's a big fucking deal there.
She reminds him, you know we will be killed if we fail.
And Ephraim reminds her, seems we both will.
To which Seffi replies, pride blinds, but sometimes it leads. I know our ways are strange to you, but hard ways are necessary to govern wild spirits. They do not see your worth, but I do, Horn. I see fear in you. Most run from that fear, but you spit in its face, as do I, as do I.
I mean, I think that what happened in the ritual bears discussion because we touched on it in the summary, but it would take too long to describe every bit in piece. The women, they put strands of their hair into the rib cage, which means they'll have to shave off their hair, which is kind of like the middling level. But Valdir and all of his men, they throw torques. And I can't remember if it says what they would have to do if they lose or whatever, but it's minimal is the point. It's basically spitting on not just Ephraim and his plan, but also Seffi for choosing his plan. So the fuck, Valdir. Ephraim, and I gotta be honest, I gotta get behind him on this, even though it was a little bit stupid and rash and he regrets it kind of immediately. I probably would have done the same thing. I would have been pissed that these people were essentially and then literally spitting on slash at me. And then I would have cut my hand and been like, yeah, whatever. I'll die for this shit. I know my plan. It's good.
Well, it's also almost the only thing he can do in that situation. I guess he could have taken the huge insult, but then all of the Obsidians also see him just taking the insult. Whereas by making the risk that he does, he actually earns some respect, certainly not from everybody, but from some, and it makes it so that it is more acceptable what they're doing. And Seffi's right too. Essentially, you got to pay the price. And that's what he and Seffi were doing.
Yeah, he could have still cut off his hair, but you're right. It wouldn't have had the impact otherwise. And I do have to wonder if he hadn't cut his hand and put his blood into the rib cage, whether Seffi would have as well.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting question.
I doubt we'll ever know, but
especially because it's specifically noted that he was being mocked for just doing his hair. And that was kind of like the final straw for him to go, fuck it, I'm going to bleed, was the fact that these people were like, oh yeah, of course you're just doing your hair. Like, you have any honor anyway. But it is interesting to wonder, like, if he had done his hair, what would Seffy have done?
She clearly has the mindset of, you spit in their face, as do I, so maybe she would have done it anyway. I don't know.
Yeah.
After this, despite Ephraim being like freaked out and regretting what he just did for obvious reasons, he really does get some great bits with a lot of characters. So I wanted to add this little side note, if you can call it that, about his conversation with Osgard right before the Obsidian go to take over the mines. Because Osgard is clearly worried, presumably about what he might have seen in the Firebones. And Ephraim tells him, I find your faith a little disturbing.
Bah, I find your face disturbing. It is soft like goat cheese, but I do not complain. You prepared Skuggy. You are good at what you do. So are they. To fret now is seed of angst.
I love that. I find your faith a little disturbing. Bah, your face is disturbing.
Your face is disturbing. Like best comeback ever.
Yeah. And then, oops. Ephraim eats some of Osgard's walnuts, which are actually his spirit berries. So Ephraim totally trips out. And listen, this whole thing is pretty hilarious. He's freaking out at first, and then he's also like, oh my God, Seffy is beautiful, and what's going on? And then he goes to hide, and it's amongst like crates with armor and stuff. He can't fit in any of the armor, but he finds grab boots and he's able to like strap them on, even though they're way too big. And he finds a rifle of unimaginable power, or whatever he says. Then he sort of feels empowered. And everything he sees after that is like, oh my God, now he's like, he's in the trip. He's in the best part of the trip after this. Like, he's past the original freak out, and now he's in the best part of the trip, which, if you've ever tripped, legit.
I have absolutely no experience of that.
I heard Nick go.
we're all shocked, Jonathan.
But beneath the hallucination, Ephraim feels the beauty and inevitability of this day. For 10 years, the Obsidians were to the Republic as Volga was to me, doggedly carrying the weight of all the rest, only to be denied the fruits of their labor. Fight, the little ones said to them. Kill for us, Valdir. Leave your homeland, but have none of our land, Seffy. Don't shop in our stores, Volga. Don't stand too tall, Volga, because we are afraid of you. Well, a pox on hypocrites, one and all. They had their chance, and now the Queen of the Valkyrie has come for their helium mines. I find myself proud of them as I laugh with the mad shaman, because in all this stupid, greedy world, the spirit comes alive when you see someone say, no more. I gotta be honest, chills. I got chills reading that. It's the only part of most of this chapter that makes any sense, because most of the time it's just about Ephraim tripping. Unfortunately. Then Ephraim dives out of the transport, is wearing no armor. Osgard is like, what are you doing? You're wearing no armor. Where are you going? And the weapon that Ephraim thought he held, that rifle of unimaginable power or whatever it was, it sounds like a fucking D&D thing, honestly. The rifle of imaginable power.
Has like plus 12.
Yeah. Turns out to just be a mop.
And but it's he only like a plus one mop.
Yeah. And he only realizes this when he lands amidst a pack of hunter-killer robots. And that is the end of Ephraim's chapters in part
what
two.
A great way to end Ephraim's chapters.
Seriously? To be fair, there is a line at the end that's like, then Seffy and Valdir land and everything just goes nuts, basically. So
yeah, but that's not the end of the chapter. The end of the chapter is him realizing that it's a fucking mop.
Ephraim did what Seffy asked him to do. Before he gets high, he's like, oh my God, they only had 3 weeks to prepare. How could this possibly work? But any thoughts on everything about Ephraim's chapters? There's a lot going on here. So Ephraim's chapters are like a story within the story. It's the Obsidian story within all of the other nonsense that's going on. It's very secluded.
Well, and it also informs what we learn in Virginia's chapters, for example. You know, like we get those two pieces, one of the Obsidians, and then as we're going back and forth between Ephraim and Virginia, we're getting these pieces of like, oh, here's the larger play. It does help redeem Ephraim to an extent in my eyes. Like, obviously, this the fact that he sold out the kids in the first place still is real not good, Ephraim. But I do really appreciate a lot of the POV in this chapter. And then also, like, we do get some really cool insight both into the Obsidians and also into Pax, who we've only really kind of like touched a little bit on in Darrow's POV previously. And then like the smallest little bit in Ephraim's POV.
We got some about him from Lyria.
That's true. We did get a little bit of him from Lyria. I feel like this is the first time we really get some insight into who Pax really is without having a Pax POV.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the little bit we get from Darrow and the little bit we get from Lyria, like from Darrow, we get petulant kid who's mad that his father is gone. From Lyria, we get kid who is being raised in a very specific way and wants to be friends with everybody, is what it kind of seemed like. And then from Ephraim, we get angry kid who is mad that he's in the situation that he's in, but weirdly enough, not mad at Ephraim. He's mad at Seffy.
Yeah.
And at his dad.
Real mad at Seffy and also mad at his dad, but in a more complicated way than he's mad at Seffy, who he's just like, y'all fucked this up.
Yeah.
He's not wrong about, but also like I can totally respect what Seffy's doing at the same time. And that's part of the reason why I really like Ephraim's. I mean, it's not a speech because he's thinking it inside his drug addled brain. But the sequence that he goes through where he realizes like, holy shit, this is actually like a just thing. And now I'm like super pumped and I'm going to charge into battle. It's like, yeah, it makes a fucking lot of sense. It sucks that it comes at the cost of parts of the Republic. But at the same time, the Republic should have done better by the Obsidians.
Right, because obviously the Reds have been part of this war and whatnot too, but the Reds are Darrow's people. And the ones that joined the war and even the ones that didn't, you know, like Lyria's camp and everything, I'm not saying they've had it easy by any means, but the Obsidians, they were told, go to war for us for all this time. And then things shifted and it's the Republic and they're still being told, go to war for us. And the ones that didn't, like Volga, are being told, you can't shop here. Don't get too threatening because we're afraid of you because you're still an Obsidian. At this point, it's almost like they are the more oppressed people than the Reds are. They were probably on equal ground before the Rising, but now it kind of feels like they're the ones that are being sent to the front lines. And I'm not saying they don't want to, but the thing is, that's all they've ever known. So that's what they do. When that's all you ever know, what choice do you really feel like you have?
Yeah. It's hard to compare Reds and Obsidians because like with Lyria's POVs, we get a good sense of what the Reds have actually been dealing with since the Rising, which has not been great. But I do think the Obsidians have a very valid reason for what they're doing.
Let's go back to what you just said about Lyria. Is it what the Reds are experiencing in general, or was it Gammas are experiencing?
We learned that the mines have basically been eliminated and then taken over.
Right, similar to what happened in Russia, that the oligarchs basically stole the mines.
And then that most Reds have been moved into camps.
Refugee camps, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess at this point, who knows whether any of those camps still exist. But like you said, I like what Seffy is trying to do here. Yeah. I agree with Electra that there's some abandonment issues in a way. Because if the Obsidians hadn't left Luna, then maybe the Syndicate wouldn't have been able to do what they did in the first place. But yeah, I mean, at this point, Ephraim is doing, he's doing his good work. As good as it can be. And I like his interactions with Pax, and I got to get behind what Seffy is trying to do, even if it maybe hasn't always been done in the best of ways. I mean, when Ephraim realizes they're on that cruise ship, essentially, he says, oh, so this is how they shuttled all of the Obsidians away without anybody noticing. Also, the cruise ship thing is hilarious. All the fish tanks are moldy and the doors are opening and closing at random. And could you imagine going onto a cruise ship and it's just a, I don't know.
Completely run down and like, yeah. It's also a great moment of self-realization for Ephraim because he has that memory of when he and Trig went there basically so that Ephraim could kind of play at being a big person. Mm-hmm. And has that kind of realization of that's who I am. I will be the person who spends all of my money trying to seem like I'm more important than I am.
Which was, again, pre-Rising, but also...
Yes, but also is kind of who he was just as a human.
The watch that Trig bought him that was a fake Rolex, basically. Yeah, yeah. But he wears it. And he never told Trig that it wasn't. All right. Well,
Trig, it really is better than everyone else.
Yeah. Too bad he's dead.
Too bad he's been dead for many books now.
All right. In memoriam, I think all we have now is Amel the Pink, who was a slave who Sethi freed and who had been serving her as far as she knew loyally all this time. But Xenophon, I believe, told Sethi that he betrayed her, and so he was chopped up and then his body was burned.
Yikes.
Yeah, yikes is right. And on that note, in conclusion, as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our Heroes Tier patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick and Jonathan. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode will cover Darrow's POV chapters from parts 2 and 3 of Dark Age. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.